I was just sitting in my office reading Hegel and hadn't realized it was 6 o'clock. I could have sat there for another couple of hours and just... I got lost. So before I forget, I have no idea how far we're going to get today. But if we get to the French Revolution, I realized last time I talked French Revolution, I didn't have to teach it. Of course, Rebecca Comey came here and spoke. Which is not happening this time, so she has a truly brilliant essay called, which is part of an even more brilliant book called Dead Right, Hegel and Terra. And it appears in the South Atlantic Quarterly. French Revolution. And I will pillage from it freely if we get there today. If not, I'll pillage from it next time we meet. She's a friend and I'm allowed to do that. So last time we ended up talking about, my claim was that the discussion of state and civil society was operating an argument similar to Marx's on the Jewish question, in that the state represented universality, civil society represented the principle of individuality, and this just tracks down, right, from Antigone. Creon represented universality, and Antigone represented individuality, only now we're doing this in its modern form. Hence, the state represents general interest, while civil society, self-interest. The principle of civil society is wealth, while the principle of the state is state power. And that, to begin with, thinking about the late Middle Ages, and its kind of series of classes, I pray for you, I work for you, I fight for you, all these different relationships to the absolute, that the noble is, and the code of nobility belongs to the state, and ignobility belongs to civil society. And that, of course, we can now recognize that these two moments of state and civil society, which we still have not got in any kind of right order, represent as the moments of the for itself, the moment of self-interest, the right of the individual on the one hand, and the grounding of that in some notion of universality on the other, that these two are reciprocally dependent in some way, but we have no way, and we're going to be following out this no way, we have no way of ordering this reciprocal dependency. Hegel thinks that he figured out a way in the philosophy of right, but here we're simply interested in the path that takes us from this original setup to the moment of the emergence of political modernity. So if modernity begins with Descartes, if the self-possession of the cogito ergo sum, political modernity will begin with the French Revolution, which is just as violent in its act of self-possession. So this is about the violent grounding of modernity. That's the movement we're going to be approaching, and approaching it through the Enlightenment, and how, as the argument's going to run forward, see how where we're going, that the classical argument is that German philosophy, beginning with Kant, running right through Schiller, the Romantics, into Hegel, German philosophy means itself to be the true inheritor of political modernity, of the French Revolution, and, as it were, carry on that revolution by peaceful means. Now, what that involves and whether or not German philosophy can do it is, of course, the question to be asked. Further, you should know, even before we get there, again, just so we have this path of spirit in front of us, that this is one of the places where it will become clear that there is no neat chronology here. Because at one level, Kant's critical philosophy precedes the French Revolution, right? And then only becomes an interpretation of its continuance retrospectively. Right? That is, after the French Revolution, people looked back to Kant and said, ah, now we can see what the foundations for it were and how better to continue it. And then, of course, as we have already seen, in The Spirit of Christianity and Its Fate, that Hegel conceives of Kant's philosophy, all this all just pointing forward, as itself a form of logical terrorism. And this idea that Kant's philosophy is indeed a form of logical terrorism is something that Heinrich Heine points out in his History of the Period. Heine says that Kant has in any case far surpassed Robespierre in intellectual terrorism, whereas the guillotine manages to kill off only a pathetic fat king who has lost his head anyway. The axe of reason has slain deism throughout Germany. And it's important, I'm suggesting that we're going to see a path here of this act of both individual and radical self-possession, and to say that's what we're heading towards, this is what the whole problem of faith and enlightenment is going to be, is to say that this whole path is setting loose not simply the principle of freedom. That's the Kantian line. It's the principle of negativity. So we're seeing the emergence or unleashing of negativity as a necessary aspect of freedom, namely its groundlessness, right? And what that means to our self-understanding as modern subjects. So this beginning point is really meant to set up this path that will take us, and Hegel thinks he can inherit all this without the pitfalls. And that will be, of course, the question for us, whether this history is inheritable. But I take it that that is our question. Right? I mean, that is, as subjects of political modernity, we are not done with that question. Right? In fact, you know, they say that the problem at the moment is we are so nervous about political modernity that we are disinheriting it at 100 miles an hour. Right? The revival of religion, the idea of communitarianism, all of these things are ways of trying to disavow the principles of political modernity. So that's the path for the next 3-4 weeks, 2-3 weeks, whatever. But if I'm really slow, we may never get there. That's the idea. So let me just quickly then say how, just in a way, so I really do want to press this thought forward, just make the obvious point about state and civil society in its first appearance, namely in forms of honor and wealth, that of course this relationship is both unstable and necessarily reversible. And it's unstable and necessarily reversible because what makes nobility noble is that it is activity done selflessly. Right? That's what it is to do something for honor. Right? And it should not be done out of self-interest. So it's done selflessly as service to the state. So it is another version. Honor, we shall say, is a value mediated version of the sacrifice of the individual to the state. And we saw when we talked about the Greek state that the state is simply, right, a machine, right, that sacrifices young men to its ends, right? Let's simply call it the Bush machine. And that we do not look at the death of those young men and all of that stuff, right? That same logic. So the early modern version of this is the theory of honor, but honor requires recognition, which is where Charles Taylor, for example, begins his account of recognition as in the early theories of honor. But if honor requires recognition, then receiving recognition is something that the individual achieves. And if it's something that the individual achieves, then it's something that they pursue. So that people pursue honor in order to be recognized. That is, if honor and recognition are non-detachable, then honor is not a pure, selfless, self-standing value, but a way or mode in which individuals are recognized, namely as honorable. But once that's the case, then it's something to be sought after for the sake of being recognized under that heading. That is, it has a necessary social content. And because it has a necessary social content, then honor is not, and here's the obvious reversal, honor is not in reality a selfless pursuit, but necessarily a self-interested pursuit, namely a goal that is pursued for reasons and to acquire something. Let's call it recognition. Further, in return for services to the state, the noble is rewarded. And surprise, surprise, what nobles tend to be rewarded with is wealth. So, nobles are rewarded with wealth, although they produce none of them. Right? Just like in our fine cousins in Washington, D.C. Halberton. Hence, and here you begin to hear exactly the note of Hobbesian skepticism. Hence the general skepticism of the mercantile and early bourgeois classes about aristocratic ideals. That what is all this stuff about honor about? Well, it's about being recognized as honorable. And what does being recognized as honorable do? Well, it gives you wealth and power, right? I mean, in other words, the skepticism about aristocratic ideals in Hobbes is simply that these aristocratic ideals have all their social significance in their mode of circulation. And their mode of circulation is as modes of power, and that power is for the sake of well, Hobbes calls it felicity, right? Self-interest. Hence, in paragraph 497,
does not find in the state power its simple essence and substance in general. It does, but not its individuality as such. So it's simply a simple restatement of the Greek problem. Right? The state provides universality, its essence, but not the moment of for itself, the moment of self-realization. And see. And that's what he goes on to say, it does find there its intrinsic being, but not what it explicitly is for itself. Rather, it finds that the state power disowns action qua individual action and subdues it into obedience. The individual, therefore, faced with this power, reflects himself into himself, and it is for him an oppressor and the bad. That is, once you recognize that there's an opposition between the so-called universality of the state and your interest, and you find that your interests and those of the state diverge, then the state no longer represents your true essence, but what everyone complained about, even about Hobbes's version of it, namely the bad, namely as tyranny, namely that which opposes the self. So this is what I meant by these roles are getting continually reversed about what's good and what's bad. For instead of being of like nature to itself, its nature is essentially different from that of individuality. Wealth, on the other hand, is the good. It leads to the general enjoyment, is there to be made use of, and procures for everyone the consciousness of his particular self. This is the rallying cry of the early bourgeoisie. It is the rallying cry of the levelers. It is the rallying cry against the royalists. I mean, this is the English Revolution. This is the Long Parliament. This is that moment when the claim of bourgeois life, as a self-moving form of life for which the state becomes merely the instrument, which itself is going to be a dire mistake, right? We call that dire mistake, right? Conservatism, Republican Party. But it comes, at that moment comes right out of this moment. that moment where, so this is, if you want a modern version of this, you can just read Nozick, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, same structure of argument.
Okay.
Well, paragraphs 5, 6, and 7 then go on to chart the consolidation of the absolutist state in France. So one of the things that's dizzy about these passages is their flip-flopping from England to France and back and forth. One of the things that doesn't appear here is Germany. Germany never got the idea of the absolutist state or the nation. It came in really late, which is why philosophy could be significant. Germany actually began to seek its unification through its enlightened representations in philosophy and music and the like. So it's that high moment of late 18th century, early 19th century German weakness, German culture, that actually was generative of the German state. So all of this chit-chat at this point is tracking the development of modernity in England and France, and then it will center on France as the home of the Enlightenment, and then drift back to Germany. Why drift back to Germany? Just so we're glad. Because Germany had something that France never had, namely Luther. So you've got to understand the development of modernity, why it's so difficult to track the complicated stories here, is in France you have the story of the development of the absolute state, which then turns into or flips into the modern state, but still carrying with it then the debate between state and church, but now the Catholic Church, while in Germany you're going to get the movement from Luther to German philosophy, and then only later a politics that's supposed to emerge out of German philosophy, that's supposed to be able to avoid the difficulties of the French Revolution. Probably told you more than you wanted to know, but it's the difficulty of telling the story of the development of modernity, right? And it's the difficulty of Hegel's story because it spirit, if we can put it this way, spirit jumps from country to country. Right? Spirit kind of appears in England and then jumps back to France and then stays in France for a while and then leaps over to Germany, and Germany looks back to Greece, and then... Just the way it is with spirit. So there is a consolidation of the absolute state in France with Louis XIV. Logically, the issue in this consolidation is... What's being tracked here is the movement, as you move into the absolutist state, the question is, well, what happens to nobility and what happens to aristocratic ideals? Right? So we're leaving behind whatever happened in England. And we can ask the question this way, namely, If willingness to risk your life loses what it was to achieve qua recognition, then recognition requires a language of recognition. So Hegel is going to look at the reality of the new absolutist state that has centralized and consolidated itself into an individual, So it's as if the absolutist state had this thought that that's right, you can't have universality without individuality, ergo, l'état c'est moi. That was the inference. I mean, that's how it got its bias.
Why it's important to see that that is different than the classical divine right theory of kings. Why that's an assertion of a certain kind of modernity, right? Because it's an assertion of the self as the representative of the state. Well, it's at this point that Hegel says that what's going to happen here is that everyone's going to have to find a way of pleasing this new king. And the question is, what do you do with a king that has absolute power? And the answer about what you do, if you're smart, is you flatter. You flatter, you flatter, and but that's to say that suddenly my relation, and let me point another way, well, what is flattery? Well, I think any of us who have ever either done it, or for those of us who haven't done it, I assume that what it's like to receive it, everyone knows that flattery is performative. That is, flattery is not a content, but a type of performance. That is, saying to someone, "Oh, you look gorgeous tonight," is not a descriptive, right? But, well, this is what this passage is going to be about. It's not a descriptive. You know, to say you are splendid, you are wonderful, you are the best king ever. The whole point here is the saying is the authority of that. There's nothing more than the performative saying. Which means at this very moment, the relationship between subject and king, if it's purely performative, becomes linguistic. So at this moment, Hegel introduces a moment in a philosophy of language and tries to think about the meaning of the relationship between self and language as we negotiate our way through the social world. And this is what is, he lays this out in paragraph 508. And paragraph 508 offers, for all intents and purposes, a slightly self-contained but unsurprisingly wholly performative conception of language. And it's fundamental to see this because I know you've all been waiting for language to appear in Hegel. Oh, here it is. And it appears in a kind of scary way. Be careful what you wish for. But this alienation takes place solely in language. And we're still in culture, we're still in Bildung here. We're asking how it is culture operates, right, as a way of trying to connect the moments of particular and universal, and how it is I form myself, right, into the kind of being who can receive recognition, right? So this is about this kind of language game as a particular kind of practice. But this alienation takes place solely in language, which here appears in its characteristic significance. In the world of ethical order belong to man, yet in the actual world, in counsel only, language as the essence for its content, and is the form of that content. So the claim there is that under most significant relations, not the ones we're looking at here, the task of language is to be the bearer of a content, right? So if I offer you a bit of counsel, say, drink water twice a day, right? The important thing is not the speech act, but the conceptual content, namely the taking of the water. Right? In that sense, language is simply the bearer for Hegel of a content that is essentially what he thinks of as conceptual. But here, in this situation, it has for its content the form itself. So what is performative discourse but using the form of language, that is, its expressive capabilities, its, well, I'll say what it is in a second, I'll let it say, its externality as a kind of content itself. But here, it has for its content the form itself. The form which language itself is, and is authoritative as language. So the point about this moment is that this is, so the kind of performance I just gave, oh darling king, you look beautiful tonight, right? That idea of performativity is language appearing as language. Why? Because it is not instrumental for a content that is independent of it. Here, the form of language, its expressive power, and the content is the same moment. Right? There isn't a separate conceptual content. Which is why I'm suggesting that hidden in this paragraph is something like a performative conception of language generally, because the claim is here, it's only under this kind of guise that language appears as language. So this is very, very close to Jakobson, right? Because Jakobson does the same thing, only he says it's poetry, not flattery, in which language appears as language, and not as message, but it's the same argument, because flattery is just the poetry of everyday life. It is my message. Just checking the doorway. So it's the form which language itself is. It is authoritative as language. It is the power of speech as that which performs what has to be performed. That is, there is no other possibility here. If you want flattery, then flattery is a language. That's all it is. It can only be done as a language. For it is, and now comes the deep note. So far, I'm pointing to, let's call it, the inevitable hollowness of language. And I'm not going to back off from that. But as it turns out, the inevitable hollowness of language reverberates into the nature of subjectivity. For it is the real existence, the Dasein, of the pure self as self. This hollow is the Dasein, the real existence of the pure self itself. Well, why? Because in speech, self-consciousness, qua independent, separate individuality, comes as such into existence so that it exists for others. Otherwise, the I, this pure I, is non-existent. So Hegel is claiming here that the only way in which a purely self-determining subjectivity can exist, and this is going to be fundamental for the rest of the argument, right? Because he's here denying that introspection, internality, self-awareness, all that kind of stuff is self-existence. For Hegel, just like we saw earlier in terms of action, right? Action is the actuality. Well, let's say that the purest actuality of the pure self is speaking. That's the claim here. I come to be for the other, that have place in the world as a subject. I performatively saying myself. Otherwise, the I, this pure I, is non-existent, is not there, is not Dasein, right? Is not present. So, you know, sometimes I look around the class and, what are you thinking, right? I don't know what you're doing, you're not there unless you say something, right? So, that's what drives the lecturers crazy. I don't know what's going on in there. And if I don't know what's going on in there, there's no there there, right? So the I there, so the thought is there can't be a there there unless you speak back. Unless you speak, you come into, right? It's a worldly existence. Both for yourself, Hegel will argue, and for the other, right? It's going to work both ways.
And not just when you speak, but when you speak in this mode of flattery, so that someone speaks up and says, you know, drink your water 5 times a day, that's just all the more unnerving. But it's only by responding to...
Absolutely, right. So, right. So the problem with why this is the self and not the saying of something serious, right, is if you're saying something serious,
exactly,
you've already eliminated yourself in the face of content. Content is subject free. Right? So the content, if it is, right? So in a deep way, it doesn't matter who says drink water 5 times a day. It's subject indifferent. But it matters terribly if it's I who say, darling, you look lovely tonight, right? And if my neighbor says it, then I'm worried, right? And positionality matters totally because that's the way the self comes forward. So the self comes forward in the moment of the act of content called emptiness. Right? Because content, we know, is universal and shareable. So only in the moment of emptiness does the self step forward. This is a terribly difficult moment in the formation of the modern subject coming to this law. Yeah?
Why isn't it, as opposed to this being a contentless performative activity by way of language, why isn't it just music?
It is. But that's the other side of it. That's what Diderot's Grammar's Nephew is about to say. That it's also just music. So this turns out to be, this is a moment, right? And it's not a self-sustaining moment. And it's not a self-sustaining moment because the other side of it is it's the radical externality of self to itself. And therefore, instead of... So, the same gesture. Isn't this the paradox of flattery? Think about what makes flattery so suspect. On the one hand, I've just convinced you, I hope, that it matters who says, darling, we're beautiful tonight, right? So it individuates, has to come from me, it's my relationship to the other. And yet, it's contentless. Right? It could be just music. That is, it is simultaneously a sheer externality. A sheer way in which I alienate myself from myself and make myself purely something in the world. So it doesn't matter, right? This is the hollowness of the court. This is why the court was thought to be by Rousseau. This is going to be the argument against theater. What you're calling music, Rousseau calls theater. And this is the beginning of the argument against theater, right? Which we'll see is what this chapter is also about. So what we're trying to get to here, this moment of language, is that moment in which, and this is only true with respect to a modern theory of subjectivity, that the modern subject must perform itself, and in that performing of itself, finds itself in a moment of radical inauthenticity. Because it's lost its relationship to its inside. Right? So this is...
Only an inauthentic creature can perform it.
Right.
Even worse.
Right. Which is a kind of, if you're a Heideggerian, you want to say this is why falling is structural. Why falling may be something you can always overcome, but it's always there. And it's there in the very mechanism of speech itself. That's what falling is about. Falling is about the inherent degenerative feature of linguistic comportment. Right? Thus mine. Or is here the court. Same. In every other expression, it is immersed in reality, and it is in the shape from which it can withdraw itself, it is reflected back into itself from its action, as well as from its physiognomic expression, and dissociates itself from such an imperfect existence, in which there is always at once too much as too little, letting it remain lifeless behind. Language, however, contains it in its purity. It alone expresses the I itself. This real existence of the I is qua real existence, an objectivity which has in it the true nature of the I. Think of this as its unfolding as a version of the private language argument. Only not about a content, but about the I itself. That would be another way of reading this passage. The I must be in its linguistic expression, and what lies behind it is going to be idle, right? Because it's going to be emptiness if it's not taken up and held in place by that form of linguistic counting. The real existence of the I is our real existence, an objectivity which has in it the true nature of the I. So the question is, how does I become objective? I'm certainly mumbling cogito ergo sum to yourself all day long won't do it. That's what Hegel's trying to get. So the objectivity of the I is going to be the speaking of the I in those speech acts whose only meaning is to express the I in its relationship to another. To put it up. So what is this? Let's call this a moment of self-theatricalization. So what I am doing here in this act of flattery is literally simply performing myself. I am your sire. I am your liege. I am, right? What am I doing there? I'm just setting up what it is for me to be I, namely my relationship to you as here performed by these expressions that have no more content than their performative content. Because I am your liege just means I'm your liege. The I is this particular I, but equally the universal I. Its manifesting is also at once the externalization and vanishing of this particular I, and as a result, the I remains in its universality. What's being said here?
raining outside. That didn't even come to me. Anybody could have said it.
No, it's not that. He's trying to think about how the eye operates as a word here. And why... So this goes right back to sense certainty.
Well, I was just going to remind you of what happened to you.
Right. Well, but that's connected to it, too much and too little. The word I is how each and every individual appropriates all of language to him or herself. So that we all can say I, right, means that it's universal, that anyone can speak language. But the word I is that moment in language where I appropriate all of it to this particular perspective. So I is that moment, right, through which the universality of language becomes particularized by an individual speaking, and in that speaking takes hold of the whole of language. Right? And we can use it as a mechanism of recognition precisely because we can all say I. Right? So in saying I, each of us takes the whole possibilities of human expressive ability from this point of view. That's the doubleness of I, and that was the argument, remember, in sense certainty. That in saying I, it meant to say just I, but it said the universal. Well, now Hegel's saying, no, the thing about the I is its capacity, right, depends on it being the universal, that's why it's called a shifter, right? A shifter because what I signifies is simply the speaker, right? But of course, who the speaker is just going to vary with who's speaking, right? So it has that capacity. So the I is this particular I, but equally the universal I. That's the one. So it's both of externalization. So the question was, why the emptiness? Well, the emptiness is because at the very moment I appropriate all to myself, indeed it is just me speaking, I'm also speaking the universal I, which is to say, let's call it the language of flattery. Right? So, as it were, there is a vanishing of this particular I. The I that utters itself is heard and perceived. A little Hegel phrase now. It is an infection in which it has immediately passed into unity with those for whom it is a real existence and is a universal subconsciousness. That it is perceived or heard means that its real existence dies away. So this is the moment at which how the original claim line is the I can only become objective by speaking of itself. Now the claim is, and that speaking of itself is the vanishing of the I. Because it will just be that language of you are so beautiful, and the I gets surpassed, so that there is something. So to say that the I is theatrical, which is what I'm saying, that the I performs itself, is to say that there is a mutual dependency between existence and emptiness, which is what is the problem of showing or appearing? the question of appearing, right, means that essence must appear. The I must appear, or it doesn't exist. But how do we stop it from being mere appearance? Well, the language of flattery is, as it were, the exemplar of that problem, because it is the case in which it is mere appearance. Right? Right? Which is why Hegel is bringing it up. It's that moment where language is doing all the work, and now we should be suspicious, independent of content. It's why we need content. Right? So the fact that this moment is necessary doesn't mean it's self-moving, doesn't mean it can collapse into music. Now is real existence, it is not real existence, and through this vanishing, it is a real, so just flopping. This vanishing is less itself, and one's surviving. It is its own knowing of itself, and its knowing itself as a self that has passed over into another self that is perceived and universal. What Hegel's doing in his last sentences is trying to understand how a certain culture, the culture of flattery, the culture of court life, actually operates as this movement between presencing and vanishing. That's the thought. So again, we might say at this moment language appears as object, which is to say it appears as itself and not as instrument or bearer or rhetoric that is empty outside. It's not an empty outside of a significant content. It's not rhetoric. The formativity is language appearing as itself. So, inevitably, given what I just said, Hegel is going to then analyze for the remainder of the next several paragraphs how silent service, or the heroism of silent service, is turned into the heroism of flattery. So all of this background about language is meant to try to understand the possibility of court life. And as court life becomes pure theater, the language of flattery is discovered, for the reasons we've already seen, to be empty. And because it's empty, the noble will detach himself from his performances, creating a certain inner self-distancing. Right? And this inner self-distancing is going to be part of the breakup of the absolutist state. Aristocracy, we may say, at this moment, so the point here is aristocracy and aristocratic ideas in France get channeled into the court. And the court then is perpetuated by the rituals of court or the theater of court. But these theaters don't even, although I want to say, I want to be very clear, this theater is utterly modern. And in its discovery of a kind of, let's call it, a pure performative modernity, a pure performance of the self, that's what makes it modern. It also discovers that it cannot be an inheritor of aristocratic virtue. That, in fact, this version, this carrying on of aristocratic virtue into court life, is in fact a terrible emptiness. And hence, as we know what happens, namely, everything moves from manner into wealth as what's important and the display of wealth. And the bourgeois ideals and reality begin to more and more become to be realized here as propping up this hollow state. So you should be hearing, you know, Rousseau's horror, right, and the rumblings that are going to lead to the French Revolution.
There are more steps, but they're already implicit in this structure of, let's call it, corruption. Now, in order to produce a veneer of respectability and continuing the theme of Bildung, the aristocrats become patrons of the arts, and Hegel calls this moment of the production of the arts as a way of propping up an actual hollow political world, pure culture. It's the moment of pure culture. And it's the moment where culture appears as a veneer or a patina or an ideology that holds this form of life and consciousness together. And it's at this juncture
where the court is trying to vindicate itself as producing, let's be clear, what's being produced here is what's called cultural enlightenment. Right? Enlightenment as music and the arts and theater and all this good stuff that happened. It's all of this as a mechanism of authority that Rameau's nephew attacks. So Rameau's nephew was introduced here as a critique of this last ideology of court life. Now, I'll say a few words and we'll have a break. The first thing you should note, people think of Hegel as only dealing with classics. This book was written in 1806. Nero, for reasons that we can try to think about, did not publish Rameau's Nephew during his lifetime. And it, in fact, appeared originally in German. And in a German translation by, of all people, Goethe. And it appeared in 1805. So here's Hegel trying to diagnose the meaning of modernity. And he doesn't reach for some grand classic. He reaches for this whacked out, excoriating, parodic satire on court life and modernity. Very hard to know exactly how to categorize this work. That had no canonical status. So I want to say that there's something radical about reaching out to Rameau's nephew here. That this is not Hegel as the classicist, this is Hegel as recognizing, as he might have recognized, I guess, in something like Tristram Shandy, a certain parodic self-consciousness at the heart of modernity here. Now, of course, what is going to be the tension in Rameau's nephew is between the nephew and the philosophe. And let's say that the philosophe, as philosophes tend to be, is dull, well-meaning, serious, and alas, unworldly, while what the nephew reveals is a many-sided and disrupted consciousness. And what he reveals above all, and here's the problem, is the problem of the relationship between individual and role in modern life. That's what Rameau's nephew is about. That we are, and we like to think of ourselves as individuals, but yet to appear in the world, we have to, as it were, put on a mask, play a role. Say the role of a philosophy professor. Now, if I want to convince you of my seriousness as a philosophy professor, I once at the APA, and I walk past the room, and there's a whole line of guys in black shirts, dark trousers, and they all had beards. They're all scratching their beards. Oh, this must be a series. They're watching NFL football. But they have perfectly got the mass of the philosopher. Now, what Rameau does is he is self-conscious about this mass playing. That is, he realizes that if roles, or rather, let's put it this way, he recognizes that roles are masks to be played with. And therefore, they are ways of manipulating your relationship to the world, and therefore of achieving self-interest. That is, in order to achieve your interest, you don't appear as yourself. You appear in a certain role, namely the role of whatever your patron wants you to be. So if your patron thinks that painters, you know, ought to look like Jackson Pollock, and you put on, you know, old jeans and paint spat in your throat, right? That's what a real artist looks like. Patron, oh, that's good, I'll buy that, right? Now, the question that Hegel then queries, and this is what Rameau's nephew is about, how do we put an end to the mass playing? Isn't the endless playing of roles as a mechanism of self-interest nihilism? That is, because how can I, if my only relationship to the world is through my masking of the world, then I can't even locate myself, because I have then relegated myself to merely the person who is the endless mask player. And therefore, the only thing I have is my ironic distance from any of these roles as my means of authority. But that means of authority is fundamentally hollow. And it's fundamentally hollow because I can't locate it, because it has no externality, because it too becomes another role, namely the role of the wiseacre who keeps saying, ah, yeah, but I'm just playing a role. And finally, the theatricality of the self overtakes the self and dissolves it. So the point is that at this moment, and this, by the way, is the same as, and that's why this passage of discussion around the nephew is so important, is the same as Hegel's critique of romantic irony. That romantic irony is, again, the gap between the self and any position it might have held. Irony is that movement of self-distance. In this case, Hegel means to be taking up a, let's call it, a universal problem. Namely, and I want to be clear, a universal problem in the nature of subjectivity. Namely, the moment of theatricality. That is, if the account of language was right, then the development of the French court for Hegel is a playing out of an ineliminable moment of subjectivity, namely, and let's be just the words, myself for others. That is, if I am to essentially, at some level, I must essentially have a being for others, otherwise I don't know what you're thinking, right? I gotta get you out, right, from speaking. But that moment, if that's isolated, and that's what the claim here is, that the being of the self for others is what gets isolated in the French court, then the logic of that is what gets played out
in the parodic self-movement of Rameau's nephew, so that, ironically, the effort of expressing myself, of making myself Dasein, exist for others, turns out to be a moment of abstraction for the self, leaving the self behind. So that there's a moment, this is what I was trying to talk about earlier, whereby I said that that falling was structural to the constitution of Dasein. There's a moment of my being for others, which I can never take back. Right? I've got to have that moment, or I'm no self at all. But that moment, if isolated, turns into its very opposite, namely, instead of objectivity, it turns into the disappearance of the self. And that is simply there in the performativity of language on the one hand for Hegel, and in the working out of the language of flattery and court life on the other. That is, I think, the whole analysis aims at a drawing out that movement. Okay, I'm overexcited, so so let's take a 5-minute break. Let me calm down, because I have to talk about serious things like faith and enlightenment. And we'll come back.